at all?
Well, I mean, I think the, I mean, there are a lot of monuments in the park right now and in the city to people that, you know, don't have much meaning to me as a contemporary New Yorker. And there aren't monuments for people like those in Seneca Village. The park is very jealous of its space, and I guess I understand that. I mean, they don't want to have the entire Green Park full of monuments, but I think Seneca Village is a significant enough community and a really unique story, and that there should be some kind of way of telling that story. It doesn't have to be a large monument, but there should be a, you know, some way for people to learn about it, whether it's on a an iPhone that you carry with you or in the school curriculum. It really, this story needs to be told
I see.
and preserved.
What do you think of the idea of something similar to what they did at Harper's Ferry, where it was totally obliterated by the war, but they came and just rebuilt it as it was, as a sort of a monument? Would you see think the idea of like rebuilding the houses that were at Seneca Village so people could have an interactive experience?
Well, I think rebuilding one of the houses, or, I mean, I don't think all of them, but I think one of them, the one that we found, because it was such a pretty house. I mean, it's such a neat space. And I also think, I mean, the Parks Department is now, and the Conservancy are now doing some renovations of playgrounds, and they have found some other remains that may be from Seneca Village, and they've done some more radar, and they may have found the foundation of one of the churches. So what I would really like to see is some more archaeology done in the park
All
to
right.
find out more about Seneca Village.
There we go. Thank you very much, Nan Rothschild, for that. She's a professor of anthropology at Barnard College and involved in the Seneca Village project. By the way, if you want to learn more, the website has a very, very long name, but you can find it easily by just typing in your favorite search engine, Seneca Village Project, and then you go right to it, and you can see photographs and maps and an interactive map. It's very interesting, the Seneca Village Project. So, Nan Rothschild, thank you very much for joining us.
And thank you. I appreciate it.
All right, great.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And so we are continuing on with this program. It's just nonstop. There's so much to talk about in a city that is a living monument in many ways, New York City. We might not know that under the concrete and under the dirt as we walk are these incredible historical remains and stories that are yet to be told. Yet to be told. So, towards that, we're going to move on to another guest who's sort of like the Indiana Jones. Well, I would say that Nan Rothschild is like Indiana Jones of New York City history. Well, she's not the only one. We have another Indiana Jones out there who's out there been finding and digging up the history of New York and telling people stories that need to be told from New York's incredible history. And this is Philip Panaritis, who's the director of social studies for the Department of Education. And he was involved, and we came to know each other when I was a teacher up in the Bronx at PS 48 in Hunts Point. And I got together with another teacher I work with in the Department of English as a Second Language, and Justin Zarka. And we started to, you know, I started to look at historical documents, and people were asking a lot of questions, started doing research on the internet, and more came out that within this industrial area, which is really known as an industrial area, as a giant truck park to a lot of people, had a deeper, much more meaningful history that hadn't been taught to many people and very few people knew about, and that it contained an ancient cemetery of settlers who had come to New York to settle, English settlers who had come as early as the 1600s, and that cemetery also contained a very much less known sort of connected cemetery or unconnected cemetery of the slaves of these people who had lived here or came here, because as we said, slavery existed in New York City until 1827. So, folks actually decided to take a look and find out if these stories and these letters and these diary entries were true. And it turned out, it seems, apparently they were. And the person who is very, very important and key to developing this, Philip Panaritis, is with us right now. And welcome to WBAI, Philip.
Paul, that was a great interview with Nan. She's one of my heroes.
Right. It's amazing what she did to find this. And that the city, I think the city should be doing a lot more, and the schools should be doing a lot more. It's great what they're doing with the African-American burial ground downtown, but there's a lot more to this history, as we're discovering today.
Well, one of the things that we did downtown was to, in the new curriculum, was to include Seneca Village as along with the draft riots, and as an integral part of the New York City curriculum. So we're pleased with that, but it's not, you know, New York Historical did a great educators packet with it, which included a lot of primary source documents. So that's one of the things that we have to, that the schools need to take advantage of. It's very, very interesting stuff.
Mm-hmm. Do they still teach social studies in the school system? I thought everything now, everybody's talking about test prep. Everything is ELA. Everything is math. Do we really have room now to teach history and to teach social studies?
Well, it's required, but unfortunately, with the pressure on to scores on English exams and math exams, by which teachers are rated and principals are rated, schools are rated, we find that in some of the elementary schools, it's not being taught in any significant way. Sometimes it's called humanities, but the kids will read a few history books, but there's actually a state curriculum that people are supposed to teach at every level. In the high schools, it's, again, tests rule the world, and so there's two exams that you have to pass to graduate. One is the global history exam, and the other is the U.S. history and geography, exam. So, yeah, it is taught at the high school level intensively as much as it was. But in the lower grades, where the tests don't drive, at least the social studies test doesn't drive it, sometimes it's not taught well, or I hate to say it, but sometimes not at all. So.
Oh, that's sad, because there's so much. Well, at PS 48, it was really an attempt. Well, part of it is that it's rare that a school sits right in the middle of history. And sure enough, Hunts Point is history. And I remember even when I was a kid, people would, you know, I grew up in Yonkers, my friends in the Bronx would always, you know, say to me, you know, in almost hushed terms about the Hunts Point area, not just because of the prostitution and the poverty and all the stuff, blah, 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 but because of the history, they said, that underlaid the surface. And I, little did I know, there was so much, that this was an area that would harbor something like a slave burial ground. Can you tell us a little bit about how this was discovered and what was found there?
Well, we found it from a photograph that came out from, it was a digital photograph from the Museum of the City of New York, mm-hmm. and it said Slave Burying Ground, Hunts Point Road, and that's all it said, and it said circa 1910.
Yeah.
Well, we had been involved in Bronx history for quite a while and never heard of that, so in fact, there wasn't even a Hunts Point Road. That had been mm-hmm. changed, and so we did 2 years of research in the New York Public Library, old maps, census records from White Plains, because this was Westchester County, you know, at the time.
Yeah.
And eventually we're able to, first we found that it was across the road from the White Cemetery. Now, the White Cemetery is still there, and those are the settlers that you talked about, the people, if you live in Hunts Point or that area, you know all those names because there's big streets, Spofford and Leggett and Hunt, all of that. So it was a family cemetery that's now owned by and administered by the Parks Department. And around 1910, they refurbished the White Cemetery. The enslaved folks couldn't be buried in the White Cemetery. It was consecrated ground. So they were buried not with stone markers, but with wooden markers with initials. They were buried in a mound across the street, and I say mound because both cemeteries, the white and the black one, were in areas that were at high tide, were flooded. So the road that went down to the Hunts Point Mansion and the dock that took all the produce and lumber down to New York City to get there, you had to cross a road that was covered with piling. So that's why they changed it around 1910 to Hunts Point Avenue. But
I see. They moved it to a higher ground area that was more direct of a route to the end of the point.
Right, exactly.
From a more winding about through the different farms area that used to be.
Correct. So we corroborated everything that we could with maps and with old text that described it. We found newspaper articles. People had visited it.
Right. And we meant some of these were fourth and fifth grade students as well.
Well, that was the beauty of it, Paul, that Justin and Grace and Anita.
My dear
and
friends,
Daisy,
people I work with, I mean, when you go through something like teaching,
teachers.
When you teach together in a New York City school with a group like that, you become like friends for life. I mean, it's amazing.
And this is one of the toughest schools in the city in terms of the needs of the kids, you know, virtually 100%. Free lunch, which is an indication of poverty, the highest asthma rates, and 13 toxic incinerators all around them, environmental racism, all of these things are happening there, and also a huge, as you know, and Justin also and Grace, ELL teachers, a huge recent immigrant population from all over the world, West Africa, Yemen, mm-hmm. Ecuador, Central America, as well as Puerto Rico and Santo Domingo. So, yeah, it's and when you see people, it just to be around them and to see that the effort that they put in, the work they do at home, the love with which they treat the children and how much they believe in them is just remarkable, and it makes my job, you know, in an office, just I feel revived every time I'm around people like that in those situations.
Absolutely.
Anyway, the beauty of the program was that when we found something in these 2 years, whether it was a census record, an old newspaper account, a map, we had a budget from a federal history grant, and we translated that into big posters, laminated posters, that the kids could then see really well. And these were kids in the third, fourth, and fifth grade, and they were able to, with good instruction, they were able to read New York Times articles, you know, a sentence at a time, take it apart. They were able to interpret the wills and the census records, which indicated the number of enslaved Africans that were there, and it was just terrific. And so they were there every step of the way, and really the story was, you know, in the New York Times and several television stations, and the story was that the kids helped find the place, and that's really true. So it's rare to see that research like that is directly incorporated into a school curriculum, and that's part of the genius that we were so lucky to have teachers like Grace and Justin and Daisy and Anita.
Yeah. Yeah, I like to have them on. We want to have them on to talk about it from the point of view of the teachers who are involved. Unfortunately, they're getting ready to teach now, so they're actually in the trenches again while we get
That's
to talk
right.
about it. And laud their work with our children, you know, because this is so important. Now, the next step was to physically go beyond the paperwork and find out that there were people buried there. How do you do that in New York nowadays?
Yeah, so we had put together all of this corroboration, and we were pretty sure where the fact is, the slave burial ground doesn't exist today. It's only the masters, and that has a wrought iron fence around it. And where the enslaved people were buried was in across a path in a little hillock that had been graded down, and next to a sheet metal factory by a road. And so we had to reconstruct what it might have looked like, because when the developers in Hunts Point, when the roads came in and there was just tons of fill that came in there and took care of all the high tide issues that existed before, we were able to to get a to really bet money that that's where it was. And then we were fortunate enough through a friend to have access to the United States Department of Agriculture, and they wanted to help the kids. The school, as you know, has asphalt in front and concrete in the back. So
sure.
Aside from some planters that Justin and his crew were working with, the kids
I helped
really
them
didn't.
With that. We helped dig that. I remember that. That was
yeah.
Amazing, yeah.
So they came up and did a soil test. But when they came to do the soil test for the to find out about the kids planting gardens and those sort of things, they also brought ground penetrating radar. And they asked us, they had to cordon off, took a whole morning to run the lines, the back and forth, up and down. And then they started, they brought out the machine, and it looked like a lawnmower, and they got magnetic resonance images from the entire place. And 2 weeks later, and Justin and I were kind of worried that, you know, because people said, well, there's nothing there, and you could do this with any cemetery. And we said, yeah, okay, let's do it for all cemeteries. But we were concerned that maybe we had gotten the history wrong or something. So 2 weeks later, they sent us back the report with anthropogenic features. So I had to look that up, but it was good. It meant that they found bodies. They found burials that were the Parks Department around 1910. The commissioner of parks in the Bronx said that he wanted to lower the hill in front from the White Cemetery to get a better view of the sound. Well, the hill in front was the slave cemetery that we had a picture of that had been obliterated, really, by the Parks Department. We're almost positive that's who did it. And but yeah, as they skimmed away all the graves and the markers, they left bodies in the ground, and so those are still there. And then the Parks Department said that they were not going to. Senator Klein here in the Bronx he wrote a allocation for $180,000 for the community to put a monument there. So that was good news. Except the Parks Department said that
I was just up there the other day with a friend of mine. We were taking our own little tour, and we didn't see any monument at all.
Well, that's right, because the Parks Department said we're not going to put a monument based on research by fourth graders.
What? So, who said that?
Well, the Parks Department said
that. The Parks Department? Who in the Parks Department said
that? Well, it's someone that has to do with monuments.
Send me an email with that person's
name. Yeah, I will.
All right,
but,
thank you.
So that slowed things down, and so now there had to be a survey by a registered professional archaeologist. So Jessica Stribel McLean, who is a colleague of Nan Rothschild at Columbia, Jessica was commissioned, and the senator came up with another $25,000-$30,000 to do a nearly year-long survey to ascertain whether there was indeed graves buried where we said they were, where the first ground penetrating radar did. So Jessica did all of the history. She checked all of our articles. She said and came out with a report that she presented to Senator Klein, to the Bronx Parks Department, and to PS 48 about 2 months ago, and she said that the research that we did was in fact right on target, and she sent the ground penetrating radar report out to Colorado to one of the best people in the country, and they concurred, they had the same findings. So that obstacle has been cleared, and now the community is involved in deciding what type of monument that we can get for $180,000. People are talking about benches and some trees and something that tells the story. One of the great things that we were so proud of doing is that there's an interpretive sign next to Drake Park with about three paragraphs. There was three paragraphs on Joseph Rodman Drake, this fairly obscure romantic poet and his life. And as a result of our research...
Who happens to be buried there, right? He's buried there.
He is buried there, yeah. And next to his sister, strangely. But anyway, so they redid the sign and they inserted two paragraphs that we wrote about the enslaved Africans. And
I saw
how
that.
They...
I saw that. That was great. I read that.
Yeah, man.
Because I had read it in the
before,
past.
So...
I was wondering about that. Oh, that's interesting. I was
yeah,
just up there a few
actually,
weeks ago.
They did some good things. They keep the park a lot better. There's still no benches and there's still no very few trash cans and no place to barbecue or sit down. But and then, of course, the argument is that the community doesn't use the park. But maybe they don't use it because there's no amenities, but that's another story.
Yeah.
So anyway, they labeled all the trees for the kids with their 17 species of trees in the park in that 2.5 acres.
Mm-hmm.
And Justin and the teachers have the kids down there planting flowers, and they measure the heights of the trees, and they take acorns and look at them, and under the microscope, Daisy Connolly does wonderful
science teacher
pressings.
There. Wonderful science teacher there, Daisy.
Yeah, she does these amazing leaf pressings with the kids. It's just fabulous. So that's their laboratory. It's 3 blocks from the school. It has the same name as Joseph Rodman Drake. The cemetery has the same name as the school. The school's 104 years old. And it's so sweet to see it incorporated into the school curriculum. And Justin and I and Grace have been able to do, and actually, Paul, we used some of your research, too, and some of the things that you found out about Hunts Point, which were really got us going. So I think you have a big part in this as well.
Thank you very much. It's great to feel that. It makes me proud to do that because, you know, I love the community there. And the more I learned about it, the more I looked into it, the more I loved it. And we were, you know, earlier on we had Alan Singer on, and he was talking about how the slave trade, the financial connections to the slave trade in New York before the Civil War. And, you know, some of those folks were those wealthy folks who lived up there, some of which are buried in that cemetery. Others are from a subsequent era who were buried out in Brooklyn at Greenwood Cemetery. But there's some fascinating history that is yet to be told.
Well, you know, some of the folks, it's interesting, the Spofford, and you looked at how they made their money, and they made their money in the cotton trade. So even if it was past 1827 when slavery was outlawed in New York, they still were making money off the unpaid labor of enslaved Africans in the South and then brokering the cotton to England and all of these places. But we learned so much about, first of all, many people didn't know that there was a sizable African-American population in that area. And in fact, Lower Westchester County, the towns of Morrisania, West Farms, Westchester Square, it was over 20% at one time of the population was black. So, you know, one in every five humans, mostly enslaved. And we also had learned from Manhattan that slavery, like Nan said earlier, that first of all, you don't think of slavery in New York. And when you do, we were told and saw instances where it was one or two slaves that enslaved people that lived in the attic or in the basement or something. But the census records for this was 12 people, 12 enslaved people, 11, 15. These were plantations. These were not people that lived in the attic. These were sizable farms where they made a lot of money selling everything, butter, wheat, lumber, chickens to... all with the unpaid labor of the enslaved Africans down through the Hell Gate to the burgeoning New York City.
So these are truck farms, basically, in the Bronx that were owned by descendants, some of them Quakers later on who became anti-slavery, but definitely they shipped a lot of those goods, those vegetables, into the markets of Manhattan every day, and and they were grown with the help of slave labor.
That's right. That's right. And... you know, we also were able to, through wills are a powerful tool, and like Nan said, we had even fewer documentary records to work with, But through wills, they actually named the many of the enslaved people. They gave them only the first name. So, and that was, we found 72 different names, and presumably those people are buried there. We do know that someone named Aunt Rose, who you turned us on to, that whole history, Aunt Rose, who chose, maybe she chose, maybe she was forced to be buried there even after slavery in the 1840s. And a man named Bill the Pilot, who worked for the Hunts, and there's a famous ship that went down.
The Hussar.
The Hussar. And Bill was hired out. Hunt got the money to take the Hussar. It was carrying American prisoners in the hold and the payroll for the Newport, Rhode Island garrison to take it through the Hell Gate and get it around the Brother Islands and up into Long Island Sound.
In a few minutes, we're going to have Kate Linneberry on, who's the author of Be Free or Die, a new book about Robert Smalls, who was a African-American pilot.
Sure.
And we'll talk more about that when the time comes. But little known, West Africa was a seafaring area, and many of the slaves who were brought wound up being very skilled pilots who brought ships in and out of the harbor here in New York.
Yeah, and so they hired Bill, but the English captain refused to take directions from a pilot that was black. So he grounded the ship, and it's still down there with its cargo, and unfortunately all of the American prisoners chained in the hold drowned, and that's a Hussar, and it's somewhere south of North Brother Island.
Did Bill survive that? Do we know what happened to Bill? I know
Bill survived it, and then according to a newspaper article, he was swimming and stoned to death by his friends. So I wonder what kind of friends they were. Anyway, suspect it was some sort of racial incident. But anyway, Bill is buried there, and Aunt Rose, and all of the various 72 enslaved people that were given back and forth to daughters and sons and like that. And Paul, we also found African names. We found a name, Kwame, which is a Ghanaian name from the Akan language for a male child born on Friday. So we found Mungo. So some of the enslaved people still hadn't had their names changed to Christianize, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. So what's we're just finishing up here. Last couple of minutes, we're talking to Phil Panaritis, who is the director of social studies for the Department of Education, and he's discussing the Hunts Point slave burial ground, which was uncovered over just the last few years. Now, you can't really. It is a law in New York, and for good reason, you can't start digging up graves wherever you find them in New York City. So that's why you have to use radar and can't really dig into the grave and see if there's bones there or anything like that, right?
Well, first of all, I was the director of social studies. Today is my last day.
Congratulations.
After 33 years, I am retiring from the board.
Well, I'm glad to have a role in honoring your 33 years of great work for the Department of Education and educating our children. So, Philip, thank you for joining us on this very important day in your life.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you. And this has been a terrific project, and I am honored to speak on behalf of the terrific teachers at PS 48 and the test scores. They have such a steep hill to climb, and every year they do their best and beyond. And the city is honored to, if people only knew, people that talk about teachers that have the summer off and go home at 3 o'clock, if they only knew the work that some of these teachers do.
Grace and Justin, I mean, they dedicate their lives to this. I don't think Grace, even during the school year, thinks about anything else. But, well, now that she has her own children, which, she has to think of them as well. But I think the children of New York City are a quick number two besides her own child in her thoughts and her actions every day of her life. I mean,
I've just been honored, Paul, to be working with and around people that that constantly remind me of the calling of the profession and the dedication. It's phenomenal.
All right. Thank you very much, Philip, for joining
us. Paul, can I say one thing?
Yes, go right ahead.
We have a wonderful website that Justin put together that has a lot of information and a self-directed tour and all kinds of documents. It's Hunts Point Slave Burial Ground. So it's HPSBG, Hunts Point Slave Burial Ground, .weebly.com.
How do you spell Weebly?